session number 10763, reel 2.
And Stan, I flew with him for about a fortnight, I suppose, or 3 weeks. He was ostensibly commanding 249 Squadron. And he was exhausted, in fact, when he got to Malta. And, in fact, I don't think really he should have been sent there. I mean, as I told you, he'd had the whole of the Battle of France, and a terrible experience. Then he'd had the Battle of Britain with Baader in the Duxford Wing, in 242, flying with Baader. And then he'd gone on after that, and he'd flown with Baader in the Tangmere wing, so he'd been at it, really without ceasing, from the beginning of the war in France, 40 onwards, and this was February 42, and he'd been at it the whole time, and he was exhausted. And I can always remember him, because I learnt more, I should think, in that fortnight or 3 weeks than I learnt from anyone else in the Royal Air Force. Stan was a Canadian in the Royal Air Force. He'd got a short service commission. And I can see he had in these old Hurricanes. I mean, he said to me, "These are terrible aeroplanes, these things, but anyhow, we've got to do the best we can." I'm getting on very well then. And he spent his time flying these blooming aeroplanes with the throttle right through the gate, so that, I mean, it was a hell of a job to keep up, because he was trying to fly in the aeroplane so fast, because he was trying to get more and more speed out of them. And this was a man who was exhausted, really. Anyway, we had this, and we learnt all this line abreast flying, because he'd been flying that with Baader in the Tangmere wing. Four aircraft, they called them finger fours, like the shape of your four fingers on that one's hand. The secret of that was that the pilots on the... If you just took two aircraft, the pilot on the right would be looking at the aircraft on the left, and everything, the sky to the left, and the aircraft on the left, the pilot in the aircraft to the left, would be looking everywhere to the right. So in that way, you got a complete cover of the whole sky. And Stan realized that with these masses of aircraft that the Germans had in Sicily, and they were building up at the time, and 109Fs at that, I mean, the only chance of real survival was that we should be able to get the maximum advantage out of the pilots that we'd got there. Well, there's no way that you were going to do it with these old Vic formations like that. The secret of the flying in Malta had to be two aircraft in line abreast, and this chap dependent on the other, and so on. And he changed that in 249 Squadron, I suppose, in about a week to begin with. And then, of course, when the Spitfire started to come in, then, of course, the thing began to change a little, although, of course, the Germans always had this enormous ascendancy of aircraft in Sicily. I mean, they had, to begin with, the order of sort of between 400 and 500 plus in Sicily, everything, bombers and fighters and so on. And what they were doing, they were sending the bombers in with a hell of a lot of fighters, maybe send a dozen bombers or something of that sort with 80 fighters. And the idea was, of course, to get the aircraft up, for Spitfires up, so that they could shoot them down. And this was all a sort of prelude to the invasion. But, of course, the trouble was that they hadn't got enough Spitfires. This was the trouble, and they were being lost on the ground, far more on the ground than they were in the air. But Stan, for those first, and as soon as the first lot of Spitfires arrived, a chap called Stan Grant, who was my predecessor in 249, he was a Cranwell trained, a first-class officer, a very good squadron commander. I became a flight commander in the squadron and served under him. And you can always tell how good a squadron commander is when you're a flight commander. You see him close to. I mean, it's like being assistant managing director to a good managing director in a company. And so then as soon as Stan arrived, Stan Grant arrived, then Stan Turner stopped flying, because Woodall, who'd been with him at Duxford and at Tangmere as the sector commander, knew that Stan was pretty well exhausted, and he then took him off. I mean, he's quite right, but he'd done his stuff. He'd been flying. He flew those old Hurricanes with us for a period, as I say, of about 2 or 3 weeks, and then to start with the Spitfires, and then he was taken off. But he'd done the stuff, and he'd transformed the flying in Malta. He became then a controller with Woodall. Woodall, I reckon, was the best fighter controller, the best controller of fighter aircraft that the Royal Air Force had in World War II. It's very easy to exaggerate, but we had so many experienced people in Malta over the years, over the time that we were there, who'd had a lot of experience elsewhere. And if you still got, there were very few survivors, unfortunately, but the people who'd known him here, who'd known him there, and who'd seen other fighter controllers as well, both in Malta and elsewhere, I don't think any of them would doubt that he really was the outstanding fighter controller. And to be honest, I mean, I think that old Woody, who was a super chap, I mean, he was frightfully boozy, but he'd been a fighter pilot in the First World War, and of course this helped him, because he understood the tactics of fighting, which, relatively speaking, were the same in the Second World War as they were in the First World War. All the principles, height and sun and surprise and all that. And he used to control these aircraft. I mean, the radar in Malta was very good, and this was a great thing. I remember Edu Neumann telling me, he said, you know, in Sicily, we never had that. And curiously enough, Francesco Cavaliera, who became the chief of the Italian Air Force after the war, chief of air staff in the Italian Air Force, and then chief of their defense staff, the first airman who became that. He was a fighter pilot in Sicily at this time, in 1942. And he said, of course, your great advantage, he told me this himself, he said, your great advantage was that you had the radar, and we didn't in Sicily. And this made it very difficult. And Woody used to see these plots building up over Sicily, over those airfields in Sicily, with the bombers gaining height, and then the fighters would take off. And he'd ring up, certainly when I was a squadron commander, he'd ring up our dispersal, our bombed-out dispersal. I think we had three chairs with sort of two legs on each, you know, and a bombed-in structure there, and we just had an operations telephone, and he'd ring me up, and he said, look, he said, there's a plot building up now, just as beginning to move south from Italy, and that from Sicily, well, that was 60 miles away, the straits were 60 miles, and he said, I'll give you the order to scramble in probably about 5 minutes, and then we'd get up, and he said, and I'll vector you, I'll get you up high up, so you've got plenty of height with the sun behind, south of the island, climb up really fast, and then I'll vector you onto these aircraft, and then you ought to be able to see them. And this is precisely the way he played it, and then we'd get off, we'd scramble, and off we'd get up, plenty of height, climb well south of the island, that is to say, if the raid was coming in the morning. These German raids used to come in like a railway timetable. They used to come in breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Just before dinner, sort of high tea time, and just occasionally they'd put in four, but normally it was three. And so if it was a morning raid, old Woody would get us up very high, 25, 26, 37,000 feet south of the island, and then he'd start to bring us in, and he would say, now, the big jobs with a lot of little jobs about, and it's about 80 plus, approaching St. Paul's Bay now, suggest you come in now and come in fast. And then you would see them down there in the sunlight, the marvellous visibility, you know, in that Mediterranean thing, when there wasn't a haze or a mistral. And then we'd come in and we'd do the interception. Now, because we'd been got into this excellent position with plenty of height, didn't always happen, of course. I mean, this is the sort of utopian concept, but it very often did happen because his controlling was so good. We'd got all the advantage of height and sun, and so we could come in really fast and get in among them, etc., etc., and then eventually have a bit of a skirmish and then go down and land. The problem, of course, was that they had so many fighters and we had so few that they'd send these fighter sweeps in afterwards, after the main raid, to catch our fellows landing when they hadn't got any petrol. And I can always remember there was a Canadian who was the other flight commander in 249 when Stan Grant had the squadron, and I was the other flight commander before I commanded the squadron and took over from Stan, called Buck McNair, who became a first-class Canadian, he's dead now, first-class Canadian fighter leader here, leading Canadian wings afterwards. And he had a fairly raw number two at the time when they were sending these guys out, who really hadn't had the experience and should never have been sent out, as I told you. And they'd had a go at a raid, and then the Germans had sent in another sort of eight Messerschmitts to clean up at the end and get after these people, and they were attacking these fellows in the circuit. I mean, we only had about six or eight aircraft, and this fellow was flying number two to Buck, and Buck said to him, "I'll cover you." I think he was Blue Two. He said, "I'll cover you, Blue Two, until you've landed, and taxi off the runway straight away." Well, that airfield at Takali was very small, and it was dusty and hadn't got proper runways or anything. And this fellow made a pass at the airfield and overshot, and Ed had to open up and go round again. Well, of course, here was old Buck with his 109s, I was ready to pounce and that, and as a fellow came round, I was flying, and as a fellow came round, I could hear him now saying, he said, "God damn it," he said, "Blue Two, if you don't bloody well land this time," he said, "I'll shoot you down myself." You know, and this fellow, I mean, it was no blooming mistake, he went bouncing down the aisle. Anyhow, he got down. But this was really the thing, that that we didn't have, until we got to that WASP situation, and Churchill realised, I mean, Churchill was a bull of Malta. He knew that the island had to be held strategically, so important. And telegram signals that he sent to Auchinleck, you know, before Montgomery took over, much earlier on, I think in about February or March, and he thought that Auchinleck was weakening on the importance of Malta, and by God, I mean, he didn't half put the boot in, and said, "That's got to be held, and we've got to do the best we can with the aircraft from the desert to help Malta," and so on. But this was the thing, that until we really got a build-up of aircraft there from the WASP, the problem was that we didn't really have enough Spitfires, and the only way that we were able to contain these enormous raids and still survive was A, because the flying which had been transformed by Stan Turner, and we'd got by then a lot of really experienced pilots who were very good indeed, that plus the controlling of Woodall. I mean, these two things allowed us to hold the line after the WASP, and then there was the build-up during the summer when that last blitz on Malta, I'd gone by then, came in October. They'd got something like 130 or 150 frontline Spitfires then, and of course it was an entirely different ball game. They had a very vicious 10 days or a fortnight of it, and they did marvellously well because Park had taken on from them, and he could send these Spitfires out over Sicily to meet these raids as they were building up. Whereas we could never do that. We never had the aircraft to do that. I mean, we just simply had to act on a sort of defensive tactic all the time. But Turner and Woodall, these were the two names. And, of course, the AOC, Hugh Pugh Lloyd. I mean, you know, and must know all those stories about him. But I have a friend, Ivor Broom. And if you haven't talked to him, he's now Marshal Sir Ivor Broom. It would be well worth talking to him. He was a Blenheim pilot, you know. He was a sergeant pilot in two group of bomber command, and then he was sent out to Middle East and then on to the Far East. And he told me once. He said, "I got this Blenheim," he said, "with my crew, and we landed at Lucca." And he said the AOC was on the isla on the airfield, and he said, "Sergeant." Broom, you're staying here. You're not going on to the Middle East. You're staying here for a day or two." And old Ivor was put on the detail for a shipping strike the next morning. I mean, he'd never been so frightened in all his life, I don't suppose. And he stayed there for weeks. And he saw the squadrons turned round in 3 weeks, those Blenheim squadrons. I mean, they did a marvellous job. I mean, from 1941 it was. But old Hugh Pugh Lloyd was the original hijacker. He used to pinch these aeroplanes. And never thought anything of it in the Air Ministry or someone from CNC in the Middle East started to cut up rough. He said, well, I'm running the show here, and he got on with it. But he was absolutely made for that place. And then, of course, Park came on afterwards, after him, and he was very good then. He'd had all the experience of the Battle of Britain. And he was able, because he'd got so many more aeroplanes, he was able to run a different show with the fighters. He'd go out, he'd become very offensive.
Can you tell me about your own personal experience of the interception of Rommel's convoys from Malta?
Well, there were really two or three features of that. So many of the attacks on the convoys were made far out from the island, right outside fighter cover distance, done by first of all the Blenheims and then the Beauforts and then the Marylands and Baltimores and that, and the Beauforts in particular. But these, I mean, they were going right out as sort of as far as the Greek islands, you know. Well, that was miles outside our range. The other thing that we saw were the fleet air arm. I mean, those fleet air arm pilots, they were all bunched at, they were all stationed at Halfar. I used to sometimes go down there with a couple of them. I used to know two or three of them. And I'd go down there for sort of dinner in the evening. And of course, the Royal Navy, they always looked after themselves. I mean, whereas our food was absolutely appalling, sort of bully beef and World War One biscuits and McConaughey's stew and so on. And here were these Navy fleet air arm fellas down there at Halfar with the best table in the island, I think, better than the governor. And anyway, they were a marvellous lot. They had albacores and swordfish, and primarily swordfish. And I can remember one, it was when that June convoy was coming in. And we'd had that battle in May, and we'd got quite a few Spitfires then. And there were two Italian cruisers right down off the Tunisian coast, just round past Cap Bon. And the convoy was then sort of approaching the Narrows, past Camp Pantelleria, which is a terrible place, because, of course, the German Air Force were based in Cagliari in Sardinia as well. And, I mean, they were attacked from, oh, I don't know, 100 miles, 200 miles the other side of Pantelleria onwards, right into Malta. First of all from Sardinia, and then from Sicily afterwards, of course, 88s, Junkers 88s, and Junkers 87s. And there were these two Italian cruisers. I can't remember what the names of them were now. And they sent three swordfish out to torpedo attack these two cruisers. Now, I can remember Woodall ringing me up, and he said, look, there are these three swordfish, the fleet air arm, are going out to attack these things in broad daylight. And he said, we've got to do the best we can to cover them. And he said, what I'll do is to wait until they've got about halfway there and then get you off with your lot. And I think we had 8 aeroplanes, actually, operational, not the 12. And you fly straight there, so that'll save the gravy. And then cover them for as long as you can and stay with them as long as you can and then come back, but don't risk running out of juice. And, you know, I can remember going out and picking these swordfish up. They were right down on the water, and we were up at, I suppose, about 8,000 or 10,000 feet. And as soon as I saw these things, it was a long way out from the island west, half the way to Pantelleria, I should think. And here were these two cruisers right down round the coast of Tunisia, past Cap Bon, and then I suddenly saw these three swordfish. And I said to the rest of the fellows flying with me in the squadron, I said, there they are, etc. Gave them the instruction and sent one section of four down to be much lower, and I stayed up myself and my other people. And I saw these swordfish start their attack. Well, two of them were hit before they reached the ships. and before they were able to let the torpedoes go. I mean, it was the blooming great big ships, those Italian cruisers were, with great big guns on them. And the thing was, it was absolute suicide. And then the other one made the attack and let the torpedo off, and he hit the blooming cruiser absolutely fair and square on, and he got back. I mean, how he got back, I simply don't know, in that sort of withering fire. I mean, there's no doubt that they were a really brave lot, those swordfish pilots, because, I mean, the aeroplanes were going along at a sort of less than the speed that they go up the M1. No, I mean, people don't realise what it was like. They were doing 90 knots or 95 knots or something. Well, if they were doing that up there, these BMWs and things, they'd just go straight past them. And I thought that they were marvellous. But now, that was the fleet air arm. That was really the only cover that I personally saw of a shipping strike. There were, of course, a number of strikes which were done at night, because, of course, from the aircraft's point of view, it was safer doing it at night, and on those bright nights you could do it and see the ships. But nearly all of the strikes were done a good long way out from Malta and really beyond the fighter cover, so I cannot honestly tell you that I actually saw it. But they were that fellow Ted Straver, that South African, who he lives up in the Transvaal. I spoke to him on the telephone, funnily enough, only the other day. And he's got a timber factory up in the mountains there, in the northern Transvaal. And he was with one of these Beaufort squadrons, and I have a feeling it was 217, but I may not be sure or right about that. And they attacked a convoy with about three or four other Beauforts. I think it might have been more than that, perhaps a flight of them, somewhere off the Greek islands, and they were shot down. He was shot down. And he was picked up by the Italians and taken into the Italian mess on one of the islands. And they were particularly well looked after, all the crew. There was Ted, the South African. There were two New Zealanders. One, I think, was the navigator. Another one was a gunner. And there was another gunner, I think, who was a Liverpudlian. Well, a South African, two New Zealanders, and a Liverpudlian. You never get anything rougher than that. Anyway, they were taken into this mess, and the Italians looked after them tremendously well and gave them a very good dinner, a Chianti, a bottle of wine and all that. And then they were told that the next day they were going to be flown into Italy, to Taranto, because the Italians were going on leave. And they were going to take, I think it was a Cant flying boat that they had, and they would take them, and then they would be taken over and made prisoners of war and all that. And so the next day they got in, Ted Straver and these other three, got into this Cant flying boat, and they had, in addition to the Cant crew, they had a corporal, an Italian corporal, armed with a revolver. And he'd never flown before, and he became really quite ill and felt terribly seasick. And Ted Straver, he's a great big hulk of a man, had a go at him and, of course, overpowered him. And they'd got this organized together. And they, in a word, took over the aeroplane. And it was the sort of first original hijack. And they said to the... to the Italian pilot, fly to Sicily, that southernmost point of Sicily, and from there we'll set course for Malta, because of course he didn't know exactly where they were and he didn't know what the course was going to be. So the thing, there was plenty of gravy in the aeroplane, so they wanted to make sure. And the pilot was saying, no, not Malta, no, Spitfires, he said, no. Ted had this gun at him. And he said, he was quite content to go to the southernmost point of Sicily. And then when Ted said, now, 40, whatever it is, 220 or whatever the heading was from there, the fellow started on again, oh, no, Spitfires, no, the Spitfires were upon. Ted got him out of the seat and took over the blooming aeroplane himself and started to fly it, and he got it onto the compass course. And of course these Italians were jumping about looking for these Spitfires, and they turned up. And when they got to within about 10 or 15 miles of the island, Ted said to this Italian pilot, "I'll get out, now you fly it in. You fly it right in as far as you can, close as you can to the island." Well, just as this chap got into the seat, two Spitfires appeared. You know, from over... they plotted this aircraft low down. They'd got close to the island by then. And so Ted said to him, "Put it down, put it down." He told us this story. And eventually they put it down. Well, the Spitfires had made one attack before the thing was put down. Anyhow, they survived. No one was hurt, I don't think. And the aircraft didn't sink, and a launch and whatnot came out and took them all off and took them in. And Ted Straver recounted this story as a captain of the aircraft. And he said, and they said, "Right, well, we'll send them off to the prison camp." "No," he said, "you won't do that. You won't do that." He said, "We're going to give them dinner tonight in the mess. They gave us a very good dinner last night," he said, "and there's no reason I should..." And so they... but they had to say to these Italians, they said, "Well, we haven't got any wine like you." "Oh," they said, "well, we've got it in our leave suitcases." And they'd got a bottles of it that they were taking home, you know, taken from the islands. And so they sat down and they had a tremendous sort of piss up, and then the fellows went off and they were prisoners the next day. And the Cant flying boat was in the end used for sort of our sea rescue, for us. But you know, there was those fellows who were doing those shipping strikes, which was the main purpose, let's be clear about it. I mean, it was the main purpose of the island, was to stop this stuff going across to Rommel. And you know, this chap Eduard Neumann that I was telling you about, I said to him, what sort of effect Edu did Malta have? Oh, he said it was terrible. He said, on the supplies going across, he said, sinking all those ships, he said it was terrible. Terrible for us, because we were short of ammunition, short of gasoline and all that. And so there's no doubt. I mean, they sunk one hell of a lot. They did a marvellous job, those fellows. But I have to say that I didn't see that because it was too far out. But they were marvellous.
Presumably you didn't have much contact with the islanders.
Well, we did and we didn't. In that time, when we had very few Spitfires, in March and April, those 2 months, which were terrible months, because there were so few aeroplanes to fly, there was an excess of pilots. And you know, we had to do something, so we used to go into Valletta and perhaps go look at a film or go in for some kind of a meal, such as a food was. And, you know, the Maltese, you could see them looking at us, and they couldn't understand why it was that we were in there when there were these blooming raids coming. They didn't realize that there were so few aircraft. And in a way, and the Maltese, I may say, don't like this. When we were out there doing that documentary for Scottish television in 1982 on the 40th anniversary of the battle, I was doing the voiceover for the thing for them, and I can remember going into that war museum in Valletta, which is a privately run place without any help from the government. Excellent place, incidentally. They've done a real good job. I can remember Philip Vello, who's dead now, he was the Honorary Secretary of it. It's run by